Hi, my name is Fraser Hayes. I'm station manager of CFUR 88.7 FM in Prince George. This upcoming conversation is one that I had with two students, Shaylin Pauls and Julian Brown, and also an administrative staff at UMBC, Gloria George, who works in the First Nations Center. We were preparing to do a documentary for the Resonating Reconciliation Project. We were going to be focusing on the Lajack Residential School. This conversation is kind of our first roundtable to talk about the topics that we wanted to focus on for the documentary. Unfortunately, we lost three elders that were going to be a part of it, four people that were going to be interviewed. We ended up not being able to do the documentary. It was just too hard of a time for the people involved. But I wanted to show you this conversation. I'd like to dedicate this discussion to the memory of Maybelle George, Nancy Anderson, Alfred Joseph, and Beatrice Morris. Thanks for listening.
What do I expect to get out of it? I always take everything I do as a learning experience. So, you know, just from what we discussed yesterday, I think it's going to be pretty awesome on like a very technical level and then a very emotional, mental state as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm just hoping for just more experience always in the end.
Yeah, for me, it's kind of broken into two different parts. There's the technical side of what we're going to be learning doing all of this, the production and everything. And out of that, I want to take away some skills and stuff like that, a little bit more of the media side of it. As far as the subject matter goes, I'm hopeful to learn things, obviously, but on that aspect of it, it's kind of more what I'm hopeful to put into it. Mm-hmm. This is an opportunity to contribute something back that people are going to hear about this content. So it's a big responsibility, I think, and I'd like us to do it in a really nice manner where we can give something towards this issue.
Mm-hmm. So have both of you guys been to Lajack before?
I've been there for the pilgrimage a few times. I remember being there. We went more so when we were kids with our grandparents. My grandma went to Lajack when she was a girl. But yeah, we went when we were a few times when we were younger, when the school was actually still there. Mm. And I remember when they tore it down. Like, I don't remember the actual them tearing it down, but I remember like going back the one year and it just wasn't there anymore. But it was always, yeah, just this big, dark, scary, dead-looking building that obviously hadn't been used for a while.
Yeah. Who tore it down?
I'm not too sure. I was probably about 10 or 12 when it came down. Yeah. So I think it's been down for about 10 years or so.
A little more than that.
Okay, so yeah, I was fairly young.
And they tore it down before they knew about the problems of asbestos.
Right.
And some of the hazardous materials that they used in building it. So they just tore it down. So there were some reaction, long-term effects from that. So they couldn't use the site for a while.
Right.
And then eventually they built a gas station across the way. They didn't build it on the site. I think there's mixed, heavy-duty, mixed emotions about it all.
Well, one thing I remember kind of raising an eyebrow at was, like, the site of Lajack is a big field, basically, like a big hilled field. Just outside of Fraser Lake, there's a straight stretch, and that's where Lajack is. If you're heading west, you have the school site on the right and the gas station on the left. Mm-hmm. It's just this long, open field, and there's like kind of rolling hills throughout it, and there's like a big rock memorial that says Rose Prince, and they have like a graveyard there, and the school was kind of up a little bit from where they have the pilgrimage. But right along the highway, and it's gone now, but in Daco Mine put in a camp there, just ATCO trailers. And I thought that was interesting how they had it, like, in the same field as, like, this old residential school site and, like, graveyard and this big pilgrimage site. So I just thought it was kind of interesting that they would put a camp there by this site that some may view as sacred. Because Rose Prince is a revered religious character for First Nations in that area, kind of like their local saint. So I just thought, I was wondering, who would have been in charge of that kind of stuff. It's not like they mined it, but it was just interesting that they had that camp set up there.
Indian Affairs would have made that decision because it is reserve.
Right.
Because when I article in law school, I used to put the contracts together and put the bids out. Indian Affairs still hires all the contractors. And I don't know, but that time, I would think Notley and Stelaco had no say in the decision.
So just based on what we talked about yesterday, we talked a little bit about the moving forward kind of aspect of it, and we thought more about that, and in terms of what the documentary could sort of portray in terms of what's next.
I think it's a pretty large question, and I always like to consult people that I know about what they think. Mm-hmm. And I think part of going to LEJEC is doing that, because, you know, it's the elders that we're seeking the advice from. You know, they contain a lot of wisdom. Mm-hmm. And not only that, just I think afterwards we were having a discussion after you guys left, and just talking about in terms of politics, you know, how do we move forward? I mean, the government put forth this apology, and that apology for some people was the first time that they actually heard about it, heard about residential school. So, you know, what exactly was he apologizing for? And then what, the following steps after of what government has done since then to enhance the lives of First Nations people without throwing money at them, or you know what I mean? So, I mean, we could definitely portray what First Nations people are doing now in terms of moving forward, because there is a lot of examples out there. But at the same time, I think it's important to have a balance between, you know, where we're going and then, you know, where some parts are lagging, because there's still a lot of hurting people out there who are just maybe not ready, or they don't know how, or maybe the programs in place have been cut, or that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely a methodical process to think about, because how do we move forward? Mm. What does that look like? And for me, I think it's really important to create these sort of connections and relationships between First Nations people and non-First Nations people, so that they understand, you know, where we are and what we've come from, and the sort of historical trauma that, you know, we're trying to heal from. And then First Nations people, you know, not having that kind of blame, you know, some have resentment, some are moving on from that, but, you know, just to have that relationship where there's no, stereotypes, no preconceived notions of who we are or who you are, that sort of thing.
Are you finished? Mm-hmm. I don't want to go off if you're still talking, but as far as reconciliation goes, something that is of interest to me, and I don't know if it'll find its way into this documentary, because it, the way I look at First Nations issues in Canada and the state of Canada today is, I think we have a long ways to go before we can get into kind of a functioning society between First Nations and non-First Nations. And I think a lot of the problem is that First Nations are usually put through the scope of Canada's scope, basically, and the problem is looked at from a Canadian perspective, and it's how can we fix this problems by Canadian means, as opposed to asking First Nations more about their culture. And I don't mean just talking to a chief and council. That is a system that's been given to First Nations people from Canada. So there's definitely a dichotomy between the leaders politically and the actual traditional leaders. I think focusing on the traditional leaders will bring out more of the teachings, and that's kind of how the communities will learn to heal themselves and stuff like that. But with that being said, in terms of reconciliation with residential schools, we were talking about these advocates who were involved in Inkane for the tar sands and Enbridge and stuff like that, and who are not just doing things like that, who people who are proponents in their community for getting the language going and stuff like that, starting these language programs with the youth and drum groups and all that kind of stuff. I think all that is great, and we should definitely include that because it's a huge, it's on the ground level of showing that there is progress in terms of reconciliation. But something that I would, that I don't know, like I said, if it'll fit into here, because it is kind of looking for trouble in a sense, but it is a real thing. And that for me is the whole concept of the reconciliation and how much authenticity is really brought forth with the apologies and stuff like that. To me, it seems as simple as, like, I just read this nice analogy about apologies and how it's like, grab a plate, drop it on the ground, now say sorry to it. Is it fixed? No. So I don't like to, like I said yesterday, I don't want to dwell on anything like that, but I think that if we allow it to be simply swept under the rug from a simple apology from the Prime Minister and a Truth and Reconciliation Week, which I do think are great steps. However, I don't think it's a effective way of actually addressing the problems. It seems to me that it's simply just okaying what happened because it says, oh, well, we've apologized now. Nothing actually has been done, but we've apologized, so get over it. It kind of puts that false misconception out there of apology, in my opinion. And I think that in order to effectively move forward as a nation, and I know this isn't going to happen overnight, there needs to be like a true connection between both people. The Turo wampum belt that the was it Haudenosaunee produced in the 1700s was just a beautiful concept. As a wampum, beaded wampum belt, it was simply two lines parallel, and it's supposed to represent two vessels floating down the river of life, parallel to each other, and never imposing or interfering with each other, living together basically in harmony was the whole idea. And I know it sounds so idealistic to say that, but it's something that I think is possible for the future. I mean, obviously, our globalized world has so many complex issues that all kind of stack up on top of each other. But for us as young and Indigenous people getting educated, I think it's important for us to bring up these kinds of things. And in terms of reconciliation on a national level, I know that some leaders don't feel or feel that this Reconciliation Week is all kind of just like I said, oh, we're sorry, everything's okay now. And to actually effectively move forward, I think that there has to be an implementation of Indigenous ideologies. Because a lot of Indigenous leaders, shamans and stuff like that, will argue that the only way to live on this earth is to live on the earth spiritually, and we can't just keep taking, and acting like it's our possession to get what we want out of and to create the society based around money and materialism and stuff like that. And I know there's bigger issues involved in that, so like I said, it's a complex web of issues, but I think that if we could at least start unpacking this reconciliation, then we're going to be creating at least better discussion for the future. And I think the future, like I said, it would be great in an ideal world to see First Nations and non-First Nations working together on with both ideologies in place and not just one or the other. And I think that seeing Indigenous people for what they truly are is how that's going to move forward. Like, if we keep looking at Indigenous people through the scope of these problems that have arisen, alcoholism, abuse, everything like that, those are all kind of trickling effects of these older issues that have taken place. So, basically, I feel like I'm just, like, ranting here. But Indigenous people will have to be allowed to be Indigenous people, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Do you see or do you accept the fact that I'm Indigenous, but I'm also non-Indigenous, as many of us are.
Mm-hmm.
Where do I fit in this scenario post-apology?
That's a good question, and that's a good point.
That is.
And I think it, that's a great way to add on to what I was just saying, because I don't want it to seem like, oh, everything has to become Indian. That's not how the world is now. And like you said, to be Indigenous and non-Indigenous at the same time is super important. I know I have a friend down south. She's a really inspiring young Indigenous woman. She's never drank or anything like that, but she's all about not only practicing culture, but getting educated. And I think that is something that would be awesome to see First Nations people doing, is not only keeping the culture alive, but also learning how to function in the modern times that we live in, because, you know, the world is now globalized, has been for hundreds of years. And if Indigenous people could not just follow their culture, but also get educated, I think non-Indigenous people would be really happy to see that too, because that shows that it's not just like, no, we're not going to get educated your way. We're not going to live by your society. But if they were to get educated, I think that it would not only enhance their position in society, but I think it would enhance their own views on their own culture as well, because there's a lot of great stuff out there in academia, no matter where you come from. And I think that if Indigenous people took that on, and maybe non-Indigenous people took on a bit of Indigenous ideology, we could see a really cool synergy come about in Canada. And in the U.S. as well, these issues are very much alive in North America. And, I mean, we've got to move. Time is going to continue no matter what. So whether we decide to move forward in a negative fashion or work towards a better future, one way or another, the time is going to pass. So I guess all we can do is our own part in all of this.
I think the truth and reconciliation process is, you know, not without its fundamental flaws. However, you know, whoever's in charge of that process, when they came to Kitsum Kalem, I'm from Kitsum Kalem, they approached it in a way that was applied to us as Indigenous people, you know, trying to, you know, apply the methodologies, you know, whether it was smudging or cedar sweeping, or they just, you know, to see that kind of, they're trying, mm-hmm. right? I think that's, you know, they can have some of that credit, but I think to have more, more impact, I think they need more consolidation with Native people. What Gloria was talking about, being Indigenous and non-Indigenous, I think is a blessing, because, you know, you have these two cultures that seemingly are so opposed just from our, you know, history, but at the same time we can definitely embrace it as Indigenous and non-Indigenous ourselves. And to put a label on our blood is a colonial way of looking at it, you know. And I know that some people are out there, they're really proud that their great-grandmother is, you know, Arapaho or something like that. And I think to have that kind of in them and just to want to embrace the culture is like, who are we to say no to that? I had more, but there's so much going on, mm-hmm. you know, I want to touch on everything. It's really hard.
Yeah, that's interesting, just that you bring that up about non-Indigenous people wanting to learn about the culture and feeling proud about what they learned about it, and even some practicing some of it. And I think at UNBC, we're pretty lucky to have a big First Nations studies program here, where people can take, anyone can take courses and learn about the First Nations culture in Northern BC. So do you guys see that as kind of a big part of the process, that sort of bringing together both sides and finding that common ground.
Yeah, I think that's a great thing, and it's awesome you brought that up, because it's true. Like, at UNBC, not only is there a great First Nations department, but I've actually been approached from a professor who said she wants to start implementing a program that it's just an idea, I think, at this point, but the vision she has for it is to kind of embrace Indigenous ideologies and try to work them into the school a little bit more. Not that they aren't being already, but... yeah, like it's not just with First Nations culture here. This is a pretty multicultural school, and it's awesome to see other people kind of embracing each other's cultures.
That's true.
I think it's sad when some people think that Indigenous ideologies are only for Indigenous people. I don't think that's. I personally don't think that's right. I mean, I think that I can understand why some people have that resentful feeling, because, like, when you look at it as this big generalized, like, oh, the white man did this to us, you know, that is one shitty way of looking at it, because it's not quite that simple.
And there's probably some protectionism happening there, too, where some people feel like that might be all they have left, right?
That's an interesting point, too. And, like, it's so hard because, like, you're drawing between something that happened then and something happening now, and it does all connect, but, I mean, you can't really blame the citizens today for something like the old governments did back then. So, I don't know, I think it would just be cool to see more, like you said, non-Indigenous people who like learning about Indigenous culture and practicing it. I don't necessarily think it's something we have to see more of, but I think it's cool when people do take interest in that kind of stuff.
Embrace the culture. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I
and it's awesome.
Think that.
It's awesome when Indigenous embrace non-Indigenous embracing their culture. Because like
it's one big embrace.
Yeah. Because like you said, like some people hold on to that, like that, like. This is ours, and that's, like, they feel like all they have left is, this is our culture, like, get out of here. And you can understand why they might feel that way, but if we could kind of open up their eyes to say, like, no, like, these teachings, if you were to ask an old medicine man from back in the day, he wouldn't say, these are only for us. Like, the concept of, you know, loving the earth and taking care of the earth, that's only for us. I'm sure they would want all people to be able to live spiritually together on this earth, because the earth is regarded as this basically big spiritual paradise where it's not about humans living on the land, it's just humans being a part of the land like everything else.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, Gloria, when you were talking yesterday about how different denominations of Christianity was the dependent factor on where the kids went. In terms of Western religion, just to complicate things more, mm-hmm. You know, it just seems like it's next to impossible to wrap your head around the implications of colonialism from that perspective and everything that came after, you know, once that Western religion came in. And then the residential schools came after that. And how does that, how was the ideology and just spirituality of Indigenous people changed before residential schools? And then, you know, obviously there's that indoctrination that happened there as well. So,
mm-hmm. It's kind of overwhelming, yeah. You know, because for me. My culture, Tsimshian, you know, we had shamans, we had medicine men, and all those sorts of things and traditions that carried on through. And when I was working for my band this summer, I was doing history research on Port Essington. It's a ghost town now, in between Terrace and Prince Rupert, and they had a day school there. But the way they lived there was both really traditional, but they didn't have, like, electricity or running water or anything in that sense, but at the same time, there was the Anglican Church and the Methodist Church, so it was you know, different because they're both trying to maintain their traditions and then be influenced by Christianity. And so it came about where some people are really for it, you know, and I see it in my families. They're really for Christianity or they're really against because of what happened in mm-hmm. residential schools. You know, they can't get past doing all this in the name of God. And I could see how that can be really, like, affect you really, you know, residually because it's just a constant threat of your identity. You know, we're treated differently because of who we are. You know, we're the people of this land. Even the word Indian, that's not who we are. And we are governed by an act called the Indian Act. It's inherent racism, you know. And before, like, how many years, 600 years ago, that word didn't even exist. You know, we were just the people of the land. So to be put under this act, to be take our children away, you know, put them in residential schools to be civilized. It's just this, who are we? And I think it's going back to the culture and going, you know, as far as we can with it. And it's kind of hard because of residential schools, but it's not impossible. I mean, we're not walking, in a sense, maybe we are walking history books. But at the same time, we're also trying to, you know, maintain our identity now, who we are as Indigenous people now, and then move forward. And how do we relay that to our children?
Yeah. And how do you make sure that history or the teachings of your elders make it to three generations from now?
Mm-hmm. I think the biggest thing is in the revival of the culture, the language, because I only understand a little bit of my language, which, you know, is another testament to the effects of residential school, that stripping of the culture and of the language, and two generations later, and I don't speak the language, so it's something I'd like to do, but from what I do understand, certain words carry these concepts within them and connotations. It's not like English that's like you add up words to try to convey a message. It's like you have to understand what this word means. A lot of it doesn't translate into English properly. Mm-hmm. From what I understand, in the more like kind of religious aspects of the culture, spiritual beings and stuff like that, it can only really be communicated through the languages. I heard one guy say, he was talking about his residential school experience and being beaten for speaking Cree, and all the kids who had learned to speak English, he had to wear a dunce cap because he, you know, would try to speak English, but he was still just trying to learn it. And if he messed up, they'd put the dunce cap on him and like make him stand by the hallway. And when all the kids went by, they'd make fun of him because he was speaking Cree. And they turned it into this like thing where it was like embarrassing to be yourself, to be your culture. And when he talks about how, you know, years later, trying to talk to the spirits, as he said, they couldn't understand him. They said that the spirits don't speak English. He can communicate that in his Cree, but in English, it's not there. So, different epistemology for sure. And it just seems like that culture, it's more than just like the way it's portrayed as. It's a really, really deeply spiritual thing that, again, like I said, it's hard to explain in English. It's kind of those things that are just so real, you have to feel it. I find that when young people start learning about the culture and the language and the songs and everything like that, you get this reaction out of them. It's like this intrinsic spark that's just like igniting. So I think that's a huge key in kind of healing the youth, but also teaching them these skills, English, reading, writing, critical thinking. And I think science is another huge thing that would benefit young Indigenous people. Sorry, I just keep this. Whenever I get into these conversations, I just get like spiraling. There's so many things to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
I think, sorry if I can.
No. Go ahead.
The community. For Julian and I, you know, I share that same. I don't speak my language either. And when two generations ago, they were fluently speaking it. And I think now what they're trying to do, and it's not for all communities, but there are quite a few, they're trying to implement those language structures, you know, very, very early, like daycare early. And I think it's when you have those cultural continuity factors that you can maintain is when is how you kind of relay of the culture of who we are, you know, in starting very young. And I think... like when you were talking about the First Nations program here, I think it's great, you know. I actually would like to see the university implement everybody to take a, you know, first year of First Nations, because then they can see how diverse it is. And but even, you know, before that, in the high schools, they don't really teach you much besides the basic, you know, social studies, like, yeah. This is who they were, you know, it's always who they were, like, that's like who we are.
Yeah, that's a really good,
that's a really good point.
Start young, like young, and my mom's a teacher, and they just, working with the BCTF, they just started the Project of Heart, and they're introducing residential schools to 7, 8, 9s, and, you know, that's a good start. I think it could go back younger, so that, you know, we'll have generations of children that aren't growing up with this, you know, prejudice or preconceived notions of who First Nations people are, and actually, you know, have the kind of ability to understand that, you know, we are the people of the land, and they're here before, and this is how it is now, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. Just the idea that no matter where you are, if you're visiting a place, you should learn about the history of the land, what the stories of the land that you're on. And I think, especially in a university town, it's tough because people come here, you know, they might live on residence, and that's their whole world, is their classes and their friends and the res. And they don't really think about the fact that they're in northern BC that has a very rich history. In terms of industry and Aboriginal use and all that stuff, it's for me, that's something that's always been important, no matter where I live, to try and learn as much about the land as I could. And it's an interesting thing you bring up, to say that, yeah, why aren't we taught that in elementary school and grade school? It's such a canned sort of list of things that you're supposed to learn. It doesn't matter where you are in Canada or anywhere. Mm-hmm. These are the things you have to learn. There's nothing regional about it.
Remember that anything to do with Indigenous people in Canada was outlawed until 1951. That's not that long ago.
Hmm. Yeah.
And so you're only talking a couple generations. And so when we were starting to work on projects for people to speak their own language in the late 70s, the elders would not do it.
Mm-hmm.
They just wouldn't do it. But then we started getting them to tell stories. And I'm talking late 70s, early 80s. And they'd tell a few stories, but not all of them. They were nervous. Mm. And then when we brought the elders to a mixed gathering, an ecumenical gathering of all Aboriginal people through North and Central America, the crew I brought in from out west were nervous about going to Morley to an ecumenical gathering. And then when they started hearing the shaman from Edmonton speak in Cree, in the Cree language, and he invited everybody to his teepee, the crew out west, totally Catholic, physically got sick, because they knew if they went to the teepee, they were going to go to hell.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had arranged for a cleansing with the Edmonton shaman and with the crew I brought in. We had about 20. And just had to have a little talking circle, and then he used a smudge. And then all of a sudden came out, that's where we do the brushings. When we're in the bush, we did brushings, because we couldn't say anything when we were in school in English, but we could do the brushings in their own language in the bush. So that's where, that was profound to see that major contrast and effect it had on them. And so it wasn't until 80s and 90s that we got people interested and a little more comfortable about talking. Now, we're getting books published. Mm-hmm. Now we have Indigenous professors. There's still count them on your hands, but we have them. Uh-huh. And we now have we have quite a few Aboriginal people in schools uh-huh. and institutions. But I have a question. Your listening audience is mostly non-Aboriginal, right? I suggest.
Well, you mean for us, just mm-hmm. our radio station? I have no idea.
And same with across Canada. I think the majority is non-Aboriginal.
For community and campus radio in general, I couldn't say, but that's probably a fair assumption.
Mm-hmm. So, you're raising very good points, right? Mm. And you're addressing it. And so, are we creating allies as we're talking about this?
That's a good question.
I would hope so. That's always what I've wanted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great question. And I think that's something that this documentary could answer. And that was going to be my next question was, Gloria and I talked about leadership and education being mm-hmm. an important part of moving forward. And I think, for me anyway, going to university and being in a leadership role, the first thing you need to learn is that you don't know everything. You know right. what I mean? Like, that's what school is all about, is finding out that you don't know anything. So my question is, if you guys could come up with just a few questions that you would like answered just in going through this process, what would those questions be? And that's a really good one. You would hope that that's the case, that mm-hmm. that you're creating allies.
Mm-hmm.
But it probably is dependent on what Julian was talking about yesterday, about dealing with those two extremes, about thinking, well, you can explain. You know what I'm talking
about. Yeah, yeah, like not aggravating anybody who's non-First Nations and trying to say, like, oh, all this evil history, you... Because it seems like a lot of people, when you start talking about residential schools, all the people who get offended by it, at least, it seems like they get this feeling that you're blaming it on them, when that's not really the case. Mm. And at the same time, you don't want to sugarcoat it for those who experienced it and feel that the truth needs to be told for what it was. Mm-hmm. So kind of trying to find that balance of meeting in between those two extremes in an effective manner to build allies on both sides and just tell the story mm-hmm. in the most authentic way.
I think what we're doing is it's a very meeting those things, like even right now having this discussion, because it's both very raw and real. And I think I always speak from my heart, and there's not, like, I've never found that to go wrong for me. And I think, you know, when you approach it in that way, people are going to see your authenticity and just feel it. And I think, you know, when we talk to the elders, we're going to find some truth into the questions that we're looking for as well. So that we can, like, just relay it. Because I don't know, I just feel like, you know, Julie and I, we have really good thoughts about this whole thing. And being at our youth age or something like that, you know, it just shows, you know, that we're walking what we're speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And that we're trying to find out more. And we're trying to, I don't know, bridge this gap maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a journey of our own as well.
Yeah, for me too.
Yeah. So are you creating an awareness so that these other people can also walk with you in your journey?
Like with the supports, or
I would like to be. I hope that is what happens with all of this. So yeah, I guess as we develop this project and edit it, especially we're gonna have to try to find a way that does that. That doesn't just say, "Hey everybody, I'm gonna get up on this soapbox and preach about residential school." And, you know, showcase a couple elders, but rather, like you said, get people to really hear the message and become allies, or maybe just get a better understanding of the way things really happened. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of like the majority will say have these very, very exaggerated misconceptions of First Nations people. Having worked in the industries before, I met not a lot of guys, but a few who were very, very blatant in their opinions towards First Nations, or as they would say, Indians. I was literally told that Indians need to get over it already. I had just a few guys who were like that, but yeah, they have a conclusion already of how they see First Nations people, and it's just they need to stop being drunks, they need to start working, they need to get on with it already, they need to forget about the past. So if we could somehow enlighten people with those misconceptions about First Nations, and maybe have them withdraw these conclusions and start to look at it from a perspective that kind of explains these issues more for what they were, mm-hmm. as opposed to what people make them.
Mm-hmm. I definitely agree. You know, just being able to change that one person's opinion, or, you know, get them on board with what we're saying, or just, you know, getting them to understand, I think is a huge accomplishment. And just, you know, how we are and how we relate to our, you know, our close group, you know, I think they can see where the passion lies, right? And for me, I always consult people about these things. I've already asked, you know, a few people, like, what do you think? Because for me, it's really important to have people's opinions, people I trust opinions, so that I have a better understanding of what they think, and then, you know, kind of put my own perspective on it, and then just, I think it's really important to have that.
And, like, just to add on to that, like, why does any of this matter? What makes Indigenous people's story worth listening to? And I think that it really connects to me, and like we were just saying, we don't know everything, and I don't want to try to seem like I do know anything or any, but coming into this academic sphere, I've noticed that there seems to be a lot of big global issues, mostly regarding climate change and energy, because people need energy, and unfortunately that comes at a cost. So if we could somehow shift that paradigm into something that is a little bit more, I hate this word, but sustainable. Well, it's not that I hate the word, I just don't like the baggage that it brings along with it. But if people start to, like, instead of pushing Indigenous culture off to the side and saying, like, oh, get over it already, you Indians, you need to pick up the pace and catch up with the rest of us, it would be cool, you know, over the next couple generations, if we could revive this culture in a sense that we could say, hey, look, people, like, why can't we all coexist? I mean, especially with the shrinking society we live in now with globalization, the internet and communication and stuff like that. We're moving, civilization as a whole is moving at a very, very quick pace. And I heard this lecture from Ronald Wright. He's an archaeologist who did a CBC Massey lecture, but he's talking about, he ties in indigenous knowledge with problems of climate change and globalization and stuff like that, saying, like, are asking the question, like, are we a train going out of control and there's no end in sight? We don't know if we're going to be derailing anytime soon. And he had a really nice analogy saying, there's too much emphasis on watching the ball and not enough on watching the game. And I think that people need to realize, like, yeah, we can't just keep using and taking and destroying and poisoning and ruining our home, because at some point everything will be tainted. And what happens to people then? And hopefully we don't have to get anywhere near that point. Hopefully people will just wake up and it be about, you know, God, it just sounds so flaky and hippie, but a society that can function together, a global society that doesn't have to be about, like, okay, we're going to have our guns drawn and we all have to walk on eggshells, but I just don't see why the world couldn't get to a place where people took the time to understand each other and there was more responsibility of man rather than man focusing on their right to do things.
What do you think makes you feel so squirmish about holistic, sustainable, that kind of talk? I feel the same way. I'm just interested to...
Yeah, I guess what it is that it can be lumped in together with really ridiculous radical approaches, and, you know, I'm sure that people would view this indigenous enlightenment, we'll call it, as a radical approach as well. But yeah, I guess with the whole sustainability thing, there's just, like I said, there's a lot of great stuff there, but there's also a lot of kind of wishy-washy stuff as well. So it just sucks because people can condemn a whole way of thinking just based on, like, a couple of the extremists who might have a pretty bit, kind of scary way of looking at it. Like, we were talking about feminism in one of my classes, and I don't want to lump feminism all together, but we were just talking about how, like, it can get this bad image because of, like, certain people within that discipline who do have really, really harsh, ridiculous ways of creating their own reform. Like, all women becoming lesbians was an example of this one scholar who was very radical feminist. And that doesn't really, I don't know, like, that's just one example, but, like, that's not going to happen, for one. But if it did, it seems like something, just like a ridiculous extreme that people wouldn't want to go along with.
I think there's that kind of thinking in everything, though. I mean, like, and it's up to people to understand and be aware of where they are placed on that scale. Because I've met Native extremists, mm-hmm. you know, and it's just like an eye for an eye kind of deal.
Yeah.
Do what they did to us. And yeah, for and me, that doesn't work.
And those, sometimes, unfortunately, those are the people, like you say, it's in everything. You start talking about sustainability, someone calls you a socialist liberal hippie right away. And that's what makes us squirmish about it. But it's the same. Yeah. It's the same with anything, like you say, you know, when you start talking about Aboriginal issues, those people that don't have a broad understanding of it will automatically say, oh, yeah, like, just let's throw them onto Lump this them. Side, because I already have an opinion about that sort of way of thinking. So it's easier for me just to do that instead of actually consider that there is a spectrum.
That's true. And that's, we're often done in that, portrayed especially in the movies, so that we're all Plains Indians. You know, we have headdresses and we ride horses and that kind of thing.
And they still do that on CBC radio. Yeah. You know, it's just so prevalent, drives me crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you hear them start talking about Aboriginal, you hear the drum and it's like, come on. It's so much more nuanced than they like to lead on.
And there's a variety of drums, too.
Yeah.
I think, exactly. Like, just talking about indigenous knowledge, people don't realize, like, you know, we had oral histories for a reason. And, you know, part of my social history research was tapping into that to affirm who we are and our coastal ties, mm-hmm. you know, because we weren't always on that reserve inland. Mm. We, you know, we're on the coast fishing, or in the winter we're more in doing hunting. And it's from those kind of things that we can be like, you know what, we can't have an oil tanker there because it's really rough waters because of my history, you know, because of my people's history in fishing and seaweed picking and, you know, just their affiliations there. And, you know, people don't understand the value of having that. And if it's gone, it's, you know, it's gone. And it all links back to resource, you know, depletion. And we are an exponentially growing population in a world that can't sustain, you know, that much land and agricultural anymore. So how do we do that? You know, we were put on these reserves, and then they want what we have on the reserves. And so how do we have that balance? And they don't understand that we're still suffering from social issues from residential schools and historical trauma. You know, and so, you know, help the people. We'll help, you know, start locally, heal, so that we can, you know, help sustain as well, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, and that's, that kind of all comes around back to that education and leadership component, where you need effective leaders to affect change. Mm. And when, you know, you talk about big issues like the Northern Gateway Pipeline and the Highway of Tears and stuff like that, it's really hard for people to know what to do with it, which is why there needs to be effective leadership from within the community to actually be able to dance with the devil, as it were, mm-hmm. and trying to affect some change from the inside, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. But. And it's hard because the numbers of effective leaders, like Gloria said about the professors, you can pretty much count on one hand. Not to say they're not there, but like when you look at effective leaders who represent Canada, there are quite a few more than effective leaders who represent First Nations communities, because mm-hmm. You have small populations and not a complete absence of, but a definite lack of education and these kind of things, with like negotiations or whatever, which is kind of why, like, I think it would be cool to get the best of both worlds, basically. Because it's not like Indigenous people were perfect by, like, there were problems there as well. And I think that sometimes you can hear, like, I hear from some people, like, oh, well, didn't Indians go and kill each other? Yeah, sure they did. I'm not trying to say that they're perfect, but if we can kind of get some of these really nice ideologies about life and sustainability and appreciating the earth, and mix it together with some other with ideologies from other cultures, then, you know, who's to say what the outcome could be? Mm-hmm. It could be something really awesome to live in to try to create like a truly multicultural society, not just a culture who claims multiculturalism, but really only likes the image of it.
Mm-hmm. Again, that was my conversation with Shailen Pauls, Julian Brown, and Gloria George up at the CIFRA studios at UMBC in Prince George, BC. I'd like to thank you very much for listening. CIFRA was lucky enough to receive some funding to hire an Aboriginal producer part-time through the summer to produce a bi-weekly documentary series about Aboriginal issues in northern BC. I want to encourage you to visit our website through the summer to hear more content like this. And again, thank you very much for listening.